cry for my country, for the pain that it's been through. She's been made to suffer for the profit of a few. Storm clouds are forming, winds of change now touch our shores. I hear forefathers are crying as the dream's been crucified. America, I show my love for thee with strength and loyalty. America, America, I show my love for you in all that I do. For my country and for friends and family. Mourning in the ignorance while staying safe within a dream. I will fight for freedom and away liberty. I die for my country, slaying corporate dynasties. America, now show my love for thee with strength and loyalty. America, America, now show and never let you down. I cry for my people in this time of tragedy. I just want some answers so the truth will set us free. Truth will set us free. I say hallelujah.
And that was Poker Face, and the song was America. This is KHEN 106.9 Salida. And thank you, Brad, for your chicken salad program prior. And after the program tonight will be Joe Frank. Tonight I have a special guest. His name is Jim Beers, and he is retired U.S. and Fish and Wildlife Service wildlife biologist, special agent, refuge manager, wetlands biologist, and congressional fellow. He was stationed in North Dakota, Minnesota, Nebraska, New York City, and Washington, D.C. He also served as a U.S. Navy line officer in the Western Pacific and on Adak, Alaska, in the Aleutian Islands. He has worked for the Utah Fish and Game, Minneapolis Police Department, and is a security supervisor in Washington, D.C. He's testified 3 times before Congress, twice regarding the theft by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service of 45 to 60 million from the State Fish and Wildlife Funds and once in opposition to expanding federal invasive species authority. And before I bring him on here, I also want to say, do the disclaimer of the opinions expressed by the host and guests on this show do not necessarily represent the views of Cahan, its staff, or board of directors. Are you there, Jim?
You bet, I'm here. So thanks for having me on.
Okay, great. I'm glad you're here. So I guess we'll go ahead and get into what you've been up to. And one of them is you're familiar with the Pinyon Canyon, what's going on in the Pinyon Canyon dispute or with the military over on eastern Colorado. Would you like to get into that a little bit?
Sure. I speak around the country quite a bit to different groups, farmers, ranchers, dog owners, rural residents, like exotic wildlife owners, and just all kinds of folks. And I write a lot of articles about the issues before us in the environmental and animal rights area, really. I try to talk about current affairs there and explain to people what's going on and try to give them some advice and help. And in that context, I was asked a while back to come out and speak to the some of the landowners in the Pinyon Canyon area that are faced with the expansion of Fort Carson. And I guess I could summarize what I talked to them about, and that might your listeners might find that pretty interesting.
Yeah, that would be great.
And what essentially is, as I'm sure most of the people in Colorado know, Fort Carson claims that it needs to expand for artillery range capability, Fort Carson area, to an enormous amount of acreage, 500,000 to 2.5 million acres somewhere, and they're very vague about that. And the way they've expanded these Department of Defense bases in the past is just like that. They sort of say they have a national need, and they pretty well get a lot of state cooperation and wind up declaring a lot of eminent domain, just taking people's property and paying them what they think it's worth, and that if people are swept out of the way. And the people around Fort Carson, which all of the expansion Fort Carson would take in private property, and the people there are not in favor of having their land taken over, and they say, why are they doing this and what is the alternative? And they don't get a very good answer from either the Defense Department or from their federal politicians. So what I suggested to them there at Pinyon Canyon is that they take some of these federal politicians that say they support them, the private landowners, and who say there isn't much they can do about it because we need this for national defense, and suggest that these federal politicians introduce legislation that says that whenever the Department of Defense is going to expand by more than, you know, for just a reasonable amount, let's just say 1,000 acres, whenever they're going to expand a Department of Defense installation more than that, in other words, a big expansion like this, they have to submit a study to and a recommendation to Congress that they have looked at least 8 other appropriate federal land units that are owned outright by the federal government and explain why they would not be a better alternative. And that of those 8 units, 2 should come from the National Wildlife Refuge System, 2 from the National Forest System, 2 from the Bureau of Land Management lands, and then two units that are suggested by local input from the people that would be affected by the proposed expansion. And what that means is that the people in Colorado could ask them to look at, say, Fort Sill, Oklahoma, as an alternative, or the Missouri River breaks up in Montana, or Central Nevada, BLM lands, other lands that if the Department of Defense says they need land like Afghanistan, that looks like Afghanistan, that to practice artillery in, they would have to look at these other federal land units. And remember, everybody kind of forgets this, but it's not written on the tablets brought down by Moses that a certain piece of land has to always be a national park or always be a national wildlife refuge or always be a national forest. Those are designations by Congress for lands that the federal government owns. And basically what I was telling people is that the Department of Defense should, by every time they want to expand their lands, should first and foremost look at other federal lands. The federal government owns probably more than 45% of the entire United States, and it's much higher percentages there in the West. And that land should be looked at before any private property is taken to expand these, to expand a national forest, to expand a Department of Defense installation, whatever. And that's not being done. We're constantly adding private property every year to the federal land units because the parks always get a few more parks every year. The refuges get a few more refuges. National forests round out their lands more all the time. And, in fact, more and more land is coming under federal conservation easements that they either fund outright or through their surrogates like the Nature Conservancy and others. And that was, speaking of the Nature Conservancy, it was interesting to me to find out that around Pinyon Canyon and Fort Carson, the Nature Conservancy was very active and was they had a post office box at one time on the fort, and that they planned to manage buffer areas and units around the edges of this Fort Carson land that would be taken because they said that there would be a mitigation area for all the property that was taken, that they would turn it into a nature area and manage it for native plants and other kind of silliness stuff like that. And the Nature Conservancy is a big supporter of these expansions of Department of Defense lands, just like most of the other conservation organizations are. And the state is a big, you know, you and I tend to think that our state government supports us, the taxpayers. In an instance like this, it's not true at all. In fact, the state government is very supportive. excuse me, is very supportive of the Department of Defense expanding Fort Carson, and not in an open way either. The state is the state supportive, but in a very kind of subterfuge way, I guess you'd say, because the state agencies receive so much money from the federal government through the federal agencies like the Fish and Wildlife Service and others. And the state agencies know that when they close down forts, like it happened recently, they had some downsizing of some forts, that land always goes back either to the federal government for a refuge or it goes to the state government for their uses. But it's private property that still rattles around with the state government or the federal government being the owners. So they all think that eventually they'll not only get ownership, but in the meantime, they will participate in the funding and management of a lot of this land, and in ways that they know are going to be useful for them to get money, because people like the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society and the Wildlands organizations and all of these radical groups see the expansion of federal land control as just a series of incremental steps to link together wildlands and wildlife corridors and to make the Front Range through Colorado what it once was when the first Europeans set foot on it with the same animals roaming around. Literally, they see that not only as a goofy goal to have all of these animals and plants that are no longer appropriate there. They want to restore those because ultimately they want to control the land and control what people are left there. They want to put most of the people out of business, not just in Colorado either. This is all over the West and up in Alaska. And it's creeping into the East, up in the northern parts of New England and down along the Appalachian Mountains, the same sort of expansion of the federal and state lands and controls through outright purchases and declaration of critical habitat here, state area there, and these easements that are tax-subsidized and grant-subsidized in many instances by these billionaire outfits like the Nature Conservancy and others who take these conservation easements that kind of control what can be done with the land and what activities humans can conduct there, and slowly decrease the amount of an economy that ranchers and loggers and rural residents can sustain there, and that in turn will help them to cut down on the recreation that goes on there and reinforce their whole approach towards closing off the public lands, not only to logging and grazing as we see, but even to access by closing down roads and having roadless areas matched up with critical habitat areas under the Endangered Species Act, match up with wilderness proposals, all of these things just steadily expanding on the federal land base as the federal land base expands itself. Then we add into that whole scenario throughout the West, we see it very clearly now, things like wolves and grizzly bears. Grizzly bears are killing hunters up in Montana and Wyoming right now, archery hunters especially. And the wolves are doing a very thorough job of reducing the elk herds and the deer herds. So there's just a whole range of tools going on here that are all growing federal programs that allow the bureaucrats to get more money for their salaries and their retirements and their bonuses, give them more power over the state agencies that are glad to get more money from the federal government for whatever purposes they can. Universities are the same way. So that we kind of come back around to Fort Carson here. And what I suggested when I was out there in my talk was that they be forced to look at the federal lands. I haven't heard any more about that, but it was an attempt on my part to use my background and knowledge to give some help to the people of Colorado that were going to be affected by the proposed Fort Carson expansion. And I hope it was of some help to them and some good for them. I don't have a lot of absolute answers, and I'm not the kind of guy that will try to baffle you with all of the trivia about little sections in the laws and the little secrets that lawyers can pull to kind of beat the federal government when they're coming at you like they are at Pinyon Canyon. I try much harder to explain things simply and to tie them back to constitutional guarantees in the United States. And I'm very very ready to make statements about certain laws like the Animal Welfare Act and the Endangered Species Act being unconstitutional and really un-American, and that unless you change some of those basic laws, which means getting some politicians in Washington that have some backbone, that the rest of these arguments about getting a little change here or a little change there with the Forest Service today or the Fish and Wildlife Service tomorrow or with the Nature Conservancy is all kind of meaningless, because this basic trend I've been referring to of tying up more and more land by the federal government that is controlled pretty much more and more all the time by these radical and extreme organizations from the Humane Society and PETA straight on through to Greenpeace and Wilderness Society, the Sierra Club, Nature Conservancy, and them. They're all involved in a very anti-American and anti-rural at this time effort to control the federal government and make the federal government more and more powerful all the time, taking over more and more power from state governments. And that power goes to the federal government, and it's really controlled by a lot of the money and lobbyists and influence in Washington by these extreme organizations. So when we talk about Pinyon Canyon, we're really talking a lot more about a lot more than a few generals and the Department of Defense and their proposals to make Pinyon Canyon bigger for whatever purposes. We're talking about the whole way that we relate to our government and our government relates to us and who's in charge here. We're supposed to be in charge of the government, And the people we elect, the politicians, are supposed to oversee the bureaucracies and the agencies. And that's not happening. It's less and less happening all the time. The bureaucrats tell the politicians what the law should look like and how they should expand it here and expand it there, and the politicians vote that in because a lot of people, mostly people that are unaffected at the time, support things. A lot of urban people support things that harm rural people. A lot of people that don't have pets or have only one pet that they love like a child in many families want to see legislation that makes other people that own horses or dogs have to comply with federal laws. There's a proposed law that would put pets under federal jurisdiction right now. So we've got a lot of people that live in the cities that support things that kind of shaft the rural countryside because the people in the city don't really care about that. They've got a vague notion that they would like to sometime go on a vacation and maybe hear a wolf howl or see a buffalo as they drive from one city to the next. And that's about as far as their thinking goes on these matters. But the politicians benefit from that is they tell them that they're going to take your property and make it into a wildlands area that will have buffalo and with wildflowers up to their tummies standing around out there munching on the grass. And a lot of people say, oh, thank you, Senator Snodgrass. So that's the kind of thing that I'm involved in and I write about and try to make 30-some years of working in the federal bureaucracy available for people and useful for decision makers. So.
Well, what it sounds like, I mean, none of this is happening by accident, and it's agenda that's taking place there, and in the little bit of studying that I could say a little more than a little bit of studying that I've been looking into on this is that the environmental groups are actually a front for something else, from what I can tell. Because this isn't just happening in this country. This is happening worldwide in a sense, is it not?
That's very true. It's happening in Western Europe. The same people and the same organizations we see here in this country, in these extreme organizations and lobby groups, we see at United Nations meetings, for the conservation of nature and that. The same groups and the same arguments are made that people in Africa should not be able to manage their elephants. For instance, there's close to 500,000 elephants over in Africa. Think of how, people out west can understand. Imagine how much food it takes to feed 500,000 elephants. And they're walking through villages and they're stepping on babies and they're destroying crops and everything else. And the same arguments are used by the United Nations to say that they can't manage those, they can't sell parts of them, they can't hunt trophies of them. And the same that they have to put up with crocodiles in their rivers, the same way that we're supposed to put up with grizzly bears and wolves, no matter where they go and what they do, whether they're killing your dog out in the yard as it goes out at night, or the watchdog you got out there, or mauling an archery hunter. We're supposed to put up with all of that, along with the livestock killing and everything else and the game killing like elk and deer, because the federal government says we should. Well, the UN says the same kind of things because of the same people and the same philosophies to people in Asia and Africa. And it's ironic, too, to me. Everybody's whining about the way Africa should be kept like it is for the, and the Africans should be kept in villages and living quaint lives, dancing around in grass skirts and that. By all of this, by the people in Europe that kind of run the UN, to be honest with you, where if you fly over Europe and you look down, all the rivers are channelized, all of the forests are pretty well planted straight lines. And they farm everything they want, and they're doing away with hunting there, and they're putting wolves all around Europe right now and protecting them in France and over in the Ukraine. They're killing people in the Ukraine right now, wolves are, but we don't even talk about that. And the same groups utilizing the United Nations in the way that we see them utilizing the federal government here in the United States, such that the United Nations gets more and more powerful through these treaties that these nations sign. The nations, in effect, give up a lot of their sovereignty and control to the United Nations, just like the state governments in the United States have given up more and more authority over animals and plants, domestic and wild, to the federal government. And that the federal government is controlled in large measure in these areas here in the United States, just like the UN, by people with these agendas. And I agree with you, and here's where it gets hard to explain this to people, because everybody gets emotional. But I guess the right word for them is kind of what you were getting at, which is socialists, that these people want the government to provide everything and be all-powerful. We've seen examples of that, you know, and remember, people are going to get very emotional when I say this, but it's true. We've seen evidence of this in the last century with the communist governments in China and Russia, where the central government's all-powerful and runs everything. There's no local control of anything. It's all central government dictatorship. We saw the same thing with Hitler in Germany, where, forgetting what was going on there because it gets so emotional talking about it, but essentially you had a central government that ran everything. The local government was appointed by the central government, just like Putin is once again doing in Russia. You appoint all the local people and the local politicians, and the local people have no say in the matter. So that whatever the central government says, and whoever controls them controls everything absolutely, is what you must do, where you must live, what you can eat, how much you can make, and everything. And all of this, the stuff that we're talking about here, from the federal land expansion, land control, to all of these environmental and animal rights agendas, all of these things are aimed at sort of establishing a socialist model of government, both at the UN level over all of the nations and within the United States, which has traditionally been one of the freest nations in the world, to change it over to a sort of central government, a strong central government. You know, essentially, it's the same thing that we had in feudal Europe, that our grandparents and great-grandparents and others fled to get away from, which is strong central governments that tell everybody what to do and treat people almost like you, not even as good as a lot of people treat their pets today. I mean, that's literally where they're going. They don't think that they, being these lobby groups, the Humane Society, the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Society, they don't believe that you and I have a right to live as we want to live. They only believe that we should be allowed to live and pursue our livelihoods as they say.
I heard Alan Watt state on a program just recently, and he said it was a statement done made by Maurice Strong at, I believe, the Rio Summit. One of those, you know, because he's been ahead of several different summits and biosphere conventions or whatever, and they were divvying out all the different rights to all the animals, and one of the people in the audience asked him, well, you know, where's the humans in this? And Alan commented that Maurice had said that by the time we're done, the humans are going to wish they had the rights of a tree.
Well, that's exactly right. And the people in the United States have a very limited knowledge of how these UN treaties on the biosphere and the conservation of nature and these other things are changing the United States so dramatically. The Endangered Species Act has turned out to authorize the federal government to take property for whenever they want to for animals. They can tell you, we've determined that there's a certain star flower on your property that's endangered, and you can no longer graze out there. Or they can tell me that there's a bird nesting on my property that in a brush that's out back, and I can never build houses there. I got to leave it just like it is, and not even pay me for any of this. And it's not for a national taking for a national interest or purpose as outlined in our Constitution, but the federal government is now allowed to do that because we signed a treaty with the UN. And that treaty really supersedes the federal government's authority under the Constitution and gives them authority way beyond what the Constitution authorizes. And the way it works is this, that talk about guns right now, we'll shift gears here a little bit and talk about the UN and how they do that. If you've been reading the paper the last couple of years, there's been two or three meetings a year with the UN and most nations talking about the problem in the world with small arms and ammunition. That small arms and ammunition are what keeps all these revolutions going. And they talk about the Congo, and they talk about places over in Asia that have got revolutions going on, and that the problem is small arms and ammunition. And the UN would like to control small arms and ammunition so that there's more stability and peace in the world, and blah, 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 we're going to stop all of this illicit flow of arms and ammunition, da-da-da-da-da. And what we need to do, in each meeting they talk about having a UN treaty on small arms and ammunition. And what is going on here is just what went on with conservation 30 years ago. Once they say, okay, we're gonna have a draft a treaty and propose it for all the nations to control small arms and ammunition in the United States, or not in the world, under UN authority, as soon as the United States signs that treaty, that treaty supersedes the U.S. Constitution, the Second Amendment, that says we have the right to bear arms. And how it does it is this. In our Constitution, it says that what's written in the Constitution shall be the law of the land, and that a duly authorized treaty can supersede what's written in the Constitution. And what the Founding Fathers were talking about, and what was certainly the only thing they knew, was that in normal circumstances, if 20 years from now a treaty with France to do certain things was in the best interest of the United States, if the President signed it and the Senate ratified it, a treaty, that treaty and the conditions that we agreed to could supersede what's in the Constitution of the United States for certain purposes, and I'm sure they had much more limited ideas in mind of treaties to have a peace somewhere, or for us to help rebuild somebody, or to stand up against another nation. But it was a treaty between us and one nation, and for things that are in our national, specifically in our national interest. That's what the Founding Fathers had in mind. But what it turns out with a UN treaty, let's just say arms and ammunition, it's going to say things like the signatory parties agree that they will register all the arms and ammunition and keep track of them so as to assure that there is no illicit flow, blah, 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 and it will control export and import, blah, blah, blah. You look at that and you say, well, that sounds pretty reasonable if in fact this is a real problem, that we agree to that. But as soon as we sign it, then the anti-gun people come along and go into court and they say, it says here that all arms shall be registered, and we're not doing that right now. The federal government's got to register arms. So some judge will say, that's correct, you got to register your arms. Then they'll say they have to control them. It says over here you have to control them. And they'll look and they'll say, well, that's correct, too. We'll have to control them. So the federal government will at first tell you that you can only have one weapon, one rifle or whatever. And then pretty soon they'll do what England does, and they'll say you got to have them leave them in the police station. You got to have a permit for them, and then pretty soon you can't get permits. And pretty soon you say, well, what happened to our Second Amendment? Well, the Second Amendment got superseded, just like all of the state authority over fish and game got superseded by a UN treaty that we signed for what we thought was the purpose of saving the elephants and the bald eagles, which was nonsense. They were both doing fine, and both are doing fine, for instance. And we find ourselves today talking about saving subpopulations of jumping mice and sand flies and plants over here, all of which are simply plants and animals aimed at stopping development, stopping fishing, stopping hunting, stopping ranching, stopping logging, closing down larger and larger areas of the rural countryside as it burns up more and more every year. And we, like a bunch of sheep, we sit and say, oh, that's because there's Santa Ana winds or more this year, you know. Oh, that's just because too many people live out there where they shouldn't live. They shouldn't be there because that's why their houses are burning up and all this other nonsense, because we're closing down grazing, we're closing down logging, which is habitat management, keeps down fuel for fires. We're shutting down roads to fight fires because we don't want roads out there for hunters and campers. And I mean, we're so easily misled about these things, it's not even funny. But getting back to UN treaties, they're very, very dangerous, because not only what I just said, but when you sign a UN treaty, you know, maybe there's 140 nations in the UN, and maybe 80 of them signed the treaty. And maybe of the 80 that signed the treaty, only 11 of them do any kind of enforcement at all. And of those 11, only one or two are going to do it like the United States is going to be called on to do it by its own courts and everything, and by these radical groups here using our court system and our governmental system. And even if we point that out, we say, oh, these nations, these 75% of all these nations don't even enforce this thing. It's not a valid treaty. That's not true. It's still a treaty through the UN. As long as there's one or two people signed onto it, we're stuck with it forever. And a lot of the purpose of those treaties and all this dancing around ultimately is to get the U.S. more in line with Europe, where the government is much more powerful and they don't have the guaranteed rights we do, so that Europe can kind of hopefully run us, or will cooperate more with them and just merge with them. This whole vague business that we see about here in the United States, the merging with Mexico and merging with Canada and having that big road go through Texas and on up to Detroit and Minneapolis or whatever it is, that whole business,
and the North
there's
American
a lot
Union.
Of people yeah. really pushing that, and they push it a lot through these UN treaties and a lot of these programs, radical programs we're talking about here, whether it's conservation easements and other things. Those things are all somewhat related and being utilized for the same purposes, which are not in the best interest at all of the people that you and I are being listened to right now by this country.
Are you familiar with Joan Bion?
No,
okay.
I'm not.
Well, I've listened to her speak numerous times, and I think she's has a site called Women's Forum. But she goes to a lot of these world meetings and has made the comment that, you know, when England started breaking up the Commonwealth, she pointed out the fact that, you know, it really looked kind of like a strategic move on their part coming in line with the UN was when they broke up, that they've now got something like 50 votes in the UN, which would they all vote for what the Queen wants.
That's correct. Just like the European Union has one government running it now, the European Union government is much more powerful. They're trying to get their own constitution in place and be over the European governments, bringing them all together. But the European countries all still maintain all their own votes. So we've got the same vote that Slovakia's got, for instance. See? And that's all, again, aimed by a lot of other people at bringing the United States much more into line with these other nations as far as their economy goes and the way they live. It's not good if you're living in Russia or you're living in Europe or you're living in China, to have, for your government to see that you understand that these Americans over here have guaranteed rights, whether it's carrying a gun, whether it's having computers that they want, or whether it's this, that, and the other thing, and you don't get it. So the governments, these other governments, don't want the United States to be sort of a beacon of this freedom and liberty business. They want it to be more like they want to run their country, which is the government tells everybody what to do, when to do, and how, you know, how big your apartment will be, and what you'll eat and what you won't eat, and what they'll allow you to see on the TV and what they won't allow you to see on the TV, and not a place where you have private property rights and where most people hunt and fish and wear fur if they want to and live on a ranch and, you know, run logging companies, and they don't want that. They don't want people that own dogs. They don't want people who can slaughter their horse when they want to.
When I started looking at the environmental movement, I was kind of surprised. I didn't realize that it was as old as it is. I mean, there were those that were really getting into an environmental movement back in about 1830s. Are you familiar with that?
Oh yeah, sure. There's always been, particularly here in the New World, there's always been a strong attachment to the study, you know, even the Founding Fathers, the study of plants and animals and wild areas. And you know, people look at sort of the wild horizon, if you will, as we settled across North America from Europe. And they you know, as they turn places into farmland and ranches and towns and cities and roads and and all of the things that we associate with civilization and the kind of life that we lead, it was always a sort of fondness for the wild areas. And then, you know, there was always an interest in hunting and fishing and just sort of the fascination with the whole thing. In the early part of the last century, a strong movement to preserve. So that's what the national forests were set aside for. That's really why they started setting aside national wildlife refuges.
Well, that it seemed like there was a major movement, you know, towards the turn of the end of the 1800s, where there was a group of writers and coming out of primarily like England that I recall, but a lot of their writings are real pertinent today, like H.G. Wells, and I can't even think of the name of the movement at that point, but it's like what is taking place right now is falling right in with what these people were speaking of at the turn of the century, and then again back in the 30s and 40s, where you have Bertrand Russell and these people have speak of these utopian one world thing, and it seems like we're following right along with what's they've been written.
That's very, very true. And I don't think we're ever going to get away from that. There's always going to be a strong undercurrent of people who, again, we're getting off into an emotional area here now when I start talking about this, but really we're talking about our concept of what man is, and I mean men and women, and the family, and what we're here on earth for. And if you've got a strong religious background to your life and believe, as most of us do, I think still do in the United States, that God made man as a special entity in the world, and we're made to know, love, and serve God, and that the animals and the plants are here for our use in doing that. If you basically believe that, then you keep in perspective the use of plants and animals. You know that it's a legitimate goal to try to preserve species and use things wisely and not use them up or destroy them, but use them renewably. But, and I think this is a growing phenomenon in the United States in the last while, and I think it was true of Bertrand Russell, H.G. Wells, okay, that you mentioned, and a lot of the people in the conservation extreme groups that we've been talking about here. It's been my experience that the vast majority of them see man and talk about man as just another animal. That it's just as legitimate to say there should be fewer people in Africa, of course, not here, not you and I, of course, in Africa. There should be fewer people, just like you and I might say, well, there should be fewer coyotes out there because they're killing a lot of calves. Well, these H.G. Wells, Bertrand Russell, and lots of the people I used to work with in the federal government and the Fish and Wildlife Service, and then I knew in the Forest Service, and particularly the Park Service, too, have a very, I don't know what the right word is here, but unchristian, very pagan.
Pantheism is what
you mean. Yeah, that really is what Bertrand Russell and H.G. Wells expressed, which is that kind of like communists believe, too, when we think of Russia and China, that people are just, you know, you can execute people if they're in the way or if you don't like what all these villages are doing, just get rid of them. Because really they're no different than all the other biological phenomena out there, you know. In the case of what we're talking about, these people get very emotional about an elephant or a whale, and not about the people that eat the fish that the whale's eating, or not about the natives that are having their babies stomped to death as these elephant herds go through the village. The same as they don't care about vacating the rural West because you're living where there's too many fires out there now, so we can't afford to protect your place. You don't belong here, and we're going to close this road off through the federal government land over here. That's too bad that you don't have access over there. You can't get in and out to your place, but you don't belong out there anyway. And you shouldn't be out here cutting down logs and the trees, so we're going to try and shut down this mill over here. And all of this, see? The cattle don't belong out there grazing on the federal land because, you know, that belongs to us, and we want that to be sacred. And we're going to go to our new priest over here, the Dr. So-and-so at the state university, who will tell us that what animals and what plants belong there. So the federal government will get rid of all those kind of plants and animals over there, and the federal government will then bring in these other kind of animals over here and plants, and that'll be what's supposed to be there. And it's too bad that elk don't like it or deer don't like it or that you can't hunt there anymore, or that you can't graze there anymore, or that there's no logging there anymore. But we've somehow brought back this sacred environment, which in so many ways, I mean, when you read Bertrand Russell and H.G. Wells, you know, it's very pagan view of the world, and they'll use government to sort of implement it. They'll bring their Brave New World about with the tax money that you and I are forced to give the federal government that will be used back on us.
Well, my understanding, though, was those guys were no different than Edward Bernays or those that were hired by the elites or leaders of the world at that point in time to put out into the public their ideas of how they wanted to socially engineer the way the world worked.
Well, that's exactly what's going on today with a lot of rich Americans, the Ted Turners and the Brokaws and the Donaldsons and that, buying their estates out there as they support all of these other programs to clear everybody else out of the way.
Well, it also sounds like, I had a lot of these questions myself, and the more I started digging into this is why things work the way they are, because I'm one that don't believe in accidents, and watching the way corporations and all these different things work, they have similarities of sorts, and governments have a similarity, and particularly when you have the merging of corporations and government, they start acting alike, and these guys have been a corporation views things out years and years and years in advance. Well, these leaders do the same thing, and they've been doing it for centuries. And their whole idea is to, even though they may not be alive when they finish their fulfilling the agenda that has been presented, but they've given themselves to that cause.
Well, the motives for what you're talking about, something that certainly has been going on for centuries, it can be described in various ways, whether it's large corporations, complex corporations, pacts between nations or whatever, for these somewhat nefarious purposes. The motives, I guess, we're always forced to say, well, what drives a person like Ted Turner to buy all the land he does and then fence it off? And so he actually supports, say, he's typical of this, but he has big staffs that run his lands for him, and they get involved on government panels, almost like state government employees, and they make recommendations that essentially there should be wolves on everybody else's property, there should be bears on everybody else's property, they shouldn't log on everybody else's property. And while they keep their own very rich interests protected, the same way that aristocrats did up in Scotland for centuries, with their own private lands up there, or in Germany.
Yeah, so they used other continents to utilize the resources that they sold and exploited.
Yeah, and as they get big, they get even centuries ago they get beyond the control of the national governments, and they wind up being so powerful that the national governments sort of bargain with them to keep them around, to keep their business, this, that, and the other thing. And that's a big problem. That's always been a big problem, and I think it always will be a big problem. I don't know that we're ever going to get away from that. And I don't say that to say, well, therefore we don't do anything about it. But I think that's something that we've seen written about by economists over the last couple hundred years, by social commentators, and alternatives to it are, you're talking about sort of forcing your government to take a hand in this and not lose the benefits that they have, that they give, in a way that keeps them lucrative and keeps whether it's the fact that they're providing oil or they're providing steel or whatever else, keep that available to the people of your country. And that means you've got to have politicians that you rely on and that look out for your best interest and not just for their own interest, their own money and whatever. In line with that, I'd point out something to you and any of your listeners out there that are still with us here in this conversation, that there was a couple of big changes made in the United States system of government back just at the beginning of this First World War that have had a very, very dramatic effect on these issues in the United States. That was two constitutional amendments were passed and approved. The first one was it changed the way that U.S. senators were elected in the United States. Up till 1913, U.S. senators were appointed by the legislature of the state they came from. Now, that meant that the state legislature, whether you liked it or not, whether it was good or bad for you, it was the best expression of the political nature of Colorado or Massachusetts or Florida or wherever in the state.
I wasn't aware of that.
Whoever was controlling it, when a Senate office came open for reappointment every 6 years, or one of them passed away, it was the legislature that came up with the next one that was going to step in there. And that what that meant was, whatever else you want to say about it, that was why there was two senators from each state, Little Rhode Island and Great Big Pennsylvania and Great Big New York, each had two senators, to preserve the state rights and state authorities and state power, okay? Because if they appointed me to be the next senator and I went in there and supported an Endangered Species Act that took away all of the authority over plants and animals in the state, in essence, gave it to the federal government, I don't think the legislature would reappoint me. And what that amendment in 1913 did, said that it would be a popular vote in the state. Now you look at that and you say, oh, that's great, you know, one man, one vote, you know, oh, that's the way to go, that's real democracy. Well, that's not exactly true here, because if we look at our U.S. senators today, and I mean in every state, not just in Colorado, I'm talking about all of them, there's still two from each state, but they don't represent the state anymore. They don't get elected by representing the state. They get elected and reelected by supporting national and international causes that get them financial support and volunteer support and media support for these radical and extreme groups that are running the government today. It's their catering to the UN and catering to the Humane Society and the Sierra Club that gets them in the newspapers and with big favorable blurbs about them, and gets them money and volunteers to get them reelected. And so they sort of play the state voters kind of like a fiddle, and you don't really have much appeal to get rid of one. I mean, it's very, very difficult to get one of those U.S. senators out. They serve in there for life, and I would submit that the next time you look at your senators, and in Colorado it's not quite as true because you guys have changed them a lot in the last couple of years, but you look at some of these guys that have been in there for 20, 30, 40, one of them has been there almost 50 years now.
Wow.
And watch the way they primp and play for the cameras and go around. They're very much like lords were back in Europe hundreds of years ago. They're like the aristocrats. And the Senate is the one that approves treaties. If you get a president that'll sign off on Kyoto or anything else, the Senate is very likely to pass most of that stuff because they no longer really represent the state. They represent these national interests that really keep them in office. The other thing that happened in 1913 was a constitutional amendment that allowed the federal government to tax income. Up till that time, they had to live off excise taxes and special assessments. They had to justify each kind of an increase they wanted and what it was for and everything, and they did just fine. We had a good, strong nation. Once they let them start taxing income, it all started off, it's like so many of these laws. When they passed it, they said it was only going to be for people that made $1.5 million or some number like that, just the rich. So everybody said, oh, yeah, great, great, tax the rich. Yeah, they don't get taxed enough. But then as soon as they got it passed, it just crept right down to where we are today, where we're all paying all the time more and more percentage, kind of like Sweden in truth, for the federal government to do all these things back on us. We keep being told we're giving them all this money to take care of us and our Social Security and get us health care and all this stuff, and they use it in large measure to buy more land, to subsidize the Nature Conservancy and groups like that and all of these radical agendas and passing all these laws. So those two things in 1913, changing the way senators were elected and allowing the federal government to tax income and thereby get an unlimited inflow of money that they just keep increasing all the time, had a very, very big effect on implementing Bertrand Russell and H.G. Wells and in encouraging the growth in that of these extreme and radical groups. Right on down to the Environmental Liberation Front and PETA and all the rest of them that are all in on this whole affair too, trying to force the federal government to make everybody else live as they want them to live and clear out the rural areas and stop people from owning any animals and certainly from using any or eating any or whatever else. It's all contributed to that.
Well, I had somebody call me up a few weeks ago and they were doing a survey and they told me they were, doing it for our state. But in the conversation, it came out that they were really from South Carolina doing this survey. And normally I don't do these things because they get to be very long and they always direct the questions. in a point, in a way that, you know, many times it's not even an answer you would even come close to answering. But I thought I would follow it out because it did have to do with environment and water, habitat, wildlife, and that sort. And I just thought I would, you know, figure out by the way they were, you know, setting up the questions where they were going with it. Well, they kind of narrowed down your hot buttons, and I, at that point in time, they'd asked me about water. And what I did with listening to the questions on the water, what they were getting to was to the point was what you were putting down your drain, whether you had any pets, whether who was in control of the water going into the river, or what you were using that might go into the ground. And certain products that you might be using. It was really looking to me like there's something in the air about them wanting to really control not only, you know, our water, but what happens with it when we're through.
Well, there's been an enormous amount of energy in the last 20 years expended in through Washington, D.C., to try to establish in court that the federal government controls all the waters of the United States, not just the navigable waters. That this is another example of these things that get started kind of like health care for poor people that just, you know, just explodes cost-wise and power-wise and everything else overnight. But over 150 years ago, the federal government was given authority and agreed to by the states that they would control, the federal government would control navigable waters of the United States.
Okay, let me just stop here for a station for the KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and this is Truth Quest with Melody, and I have with me Jim Beers with the Fish and Wildlife, has been retired from the Fish and Wildlife, and we're speaking about various aspects that are related to it. Okay.
Well, getting back to the effort in the United States in the last 20 years for the federal government to expand the concept of navigable waters, which was originally intended to only be things like the Mississippi River, New Orleans Harbor, New York Harbor, that the navigable waters would be sort of regulated by the Coast Guard, and there would be buoys put here and there and charts made and offices that conducted the flow and everything established, and dams put in so that they could move barges up and down the river, that kind of navigable waters. Well, these extreme groups and radical groups, just like they're doing with wilderness areas and with wild lands and with the Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and the Animal Welfare Act, the same thing. They wanted to expand this federal authority to say that navigable waters really means all the waters of the United States. It means wetlands up in the Dakotas, the little potholes that sit there. It means creeks running through New York State that run into rivers there. It means the rivers that run into the navigable waters. It means the lakes, wherever they may be, that, in fact, all of this is under the authority of the federal government. And, of course, you don't need to worry, blah, blah, blah. But clearly, they'll do the same thing there if they can establish that authority of the federal government over navigable waters. They'll do the same thing, which is overnight expand the concept of what's covered. Just like I explained earlier about the Second Amendment, if we sign a treaty with the UN covering small arms and ammunition, destroy the Second Amendment, and put the federal government into complete control of that, the federal government will take over what plants are in the waters of the United States, the ponds, the wetlands, the marshes, the rivers, the lakes, whatever. What fish are there? They'll start in with the certain fish don't belong there. And while you you may be thinking about certain kinds of carp or certain bullheads or something that you don't like in the streams near you. They're thinking about getting rid of all of the fish that are fished for by the sportsmen up in the Great Lakes that have been stocked up in there. They're thinking about bass that have been putting out in the west where they didn't originally occur, introduced by the states for fishing. And they're thinking about all the exotic brown trout and rainbow trout that don't belong in those streams, and they want to get those back to, you know, bull trout or some other trout that's not a very fishable species. All of it aimed at cutting down on fishing, cutting down on hunting, cutting down on the use of the water for irrigation, the use of the water for livestock, the use of the water for rural home sites. And clearly, the kind of thing you were talking about could very well have been funded by the Sierra Club or one of those outfits, that with the intent of establishing that there are certain percentage of harmful chemicals that every average family puts into their water, and the county governments and the state governments are doing nothing to control the influx of blah, blah, blah from, you know, detergent or because you've got kids in the house or, you know, old glass bottles of baby food or whatever it is that they want to invent some sort of a danger from. And they could very easily be collecting information like that that they will pop back out in a month or two in the newspapers, not so much as what you answered, as a twist of that data to support the need for the federal government to have more control over the navigable waters of the United States. And, you know, the truth is the state governments, like I said earlier about Pinyon Canyon, the state fish and wildlife agencies, the state highway departments, all of them get more and more of their money all the time and more of their direction from the federal agencies in Washington, D.C., or they don't get the money.
Well, there's an agenda there, that's the tough part about it. And I watch this on any, you know, just little small groups that will start up as a nonprofit organization, and they start looking for grants and things of that sort, and they don't realize when they start applying for those grants, there's usually strings tied to that.
Well, of course there are. It's like I said earlier, in the last day or two, there's been articles in our papers back here in Washington, D.C., that we're supposed to get all upset about that because the Saudi Arabians are giving millions and millions of dollars to a lot of our big universities, Harvard, Georgetown, and these universities, giving them millions of dollars to establish an Islamic studies department. And these, according to the papers, these Islamic studies departments are little more than sort of apologists for anything that happens in the Middle East. And people, professors who are not supportive of Muslim government actions in the Middle East are not appointed in those departments or whatever. Well, you and I look at that and we clearly say, wow, that's not good. You know, we shouldn't have these universities and those departments that are so biased about these things like terrorism and all of that, blah, 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 blah. We pick that up immediately. But when I write or when I tell people that that's exactly what's going on for the last 30 years with endangered species grants and marine mammal protection grants, animal welfare grants to the state veterinarian school and to the animal use committees and to the researchers on whales and the researchers on plants and animals. And it, in the same way, it establishes a bias to protect them and save them and stop the use of them and justify setting aside wildernesses and sanctuaries for them and to show that they aren't where they belong right now and that we need more of them over here and to do all the things that grow the government.
Yeah, but when you look back into the history of, again, on this, you're looking back to some of the people like the Rockefellers that had an agenda, and so what they would do is they would give money to these organizations, and they founded a lot of them.
That's true. But, I would suggest that you think about this today, that these universities and science and best science are almost like the Bible and the preachers of this sort of religion we were referring to about Bertrand Russell and H.G. Wells and what we see today about native species and native ecosystems. That's all that belongs here. These other plants and animals are all bad and they should be gotten rid of, and man has no right to use the animals. It's being set up in these laws that the politicians and the bureaucrats can point to say, well, Dr. So-and-so says that only this plant belongs here, and he's over here, Professor So-and-so is the one who knows all about these bats, and they belong over here, and they used to be here in large numbers, and they're not here anymore, and therefore we've got to have a program under the provisions of the Endangered Species Act, and he's given us all the data. Well, he's the only one that knows about bats, but be that as it may, you get every bit as slanted a view of these matters as you get in these Islamic studies departments that are funded by foreign powers.
Okay, going back to Rockefeller again, and I've run across this statement by him several times, and I'm not sure if it's in his memoirs or not. I've got them, and I haven't. I just got it. I've run across it two or three times where he was claiming that he was going to use the environmental movement to fit the agenda of them working towards a global system, and that these foundations and that sort of thing overly influence. And they start using these words that they, you know, like sustainable. And, I mean, I can't tell you how many times lately I've heard that word sustainable. And most of them, I want to ask them, what do you mean by sustainable? Tell me what this particular thing is in sustainable. I mean, you hear it about the ethanol or whatever, but then you hear that it uses up so much water. Does that make it sustainable?
Well, to me, the perversion of that word sustainable in recent years is the kind of thing that Orwell spoke about in some of his writings, about the way the communist governments would make words mean the opposite of what they meant. In other words,
right.
The communists would tell people that they would have that it was peace through war, and that they were, you know, you'd listen to what the government tells you and you believe that, even though the word, we're going to have peace now because you're going to fight for the government to do bad things, that misuse of the word, you come to accept it. The word sustainable was a very perfectly legitimate word for 100 years regarding the study and the science of managing plants and animals in ways that didn't destroy them. When we wanted to use grasses and that, we grazed them in a way that we always had grass the next year to sustain in a sustainable way. When we cut trees, we cut them in such a way that the resources of the trees that we had to deal with, we would do it in such a way that good quality trees would be available every year for as far into the future as you can imagine. The same with big game animals. We would kill certain kinds at certain times of the year, depending on what their population was doing, in a way that they we'd still have the hunting season next year and the year after and the year after. Same with fisheries, same with commercial fisheries. We managed them and, in fact, used them in ways that were sustainable. We didn't just kill them all off. We didn't catch all the cod and then just move on to something else.
Well, getting back to the Pinyon Canyon thing a little bit, and when you were talking about the conservation easements and these sort of things, when you stand back and look at the big picture, and what you were talking about, they're getting more and more land. Well, if it's through the military, if it's through a conservation easement, if it's through people losing their land to the mortgage companies, that ends up being those mortgages being bought up by a foreign a foreigner or a foreign government or something of that sort. It's, you know, I mean, we're looking at little pieces And if you start connecting the dots, it looks like there's an agenda of the land and private property is starting to disappear.
And well, there's no doubt about that. I mean, that's just as plain as the nose on your face. If you watch the increase in federal property that's going on, that's the only place it can come from.
But private property is what makes the middle class.
Oh yeah.
And if we destroy the middle class, then we
but
have.
Federal property is what makes a strong dictatorship, makes a strong central government. The more they own, the more they can claim that they have power over, the less powerful the people are that are below them.
Okay, but then again, wasn't the national parks kind of turned over to UN control? Are you familiar with that?
Well, there's deep cooperation between them. And I've been to numerous meetings here in Washington where the UN people sit in the corner and the people that run our agencies that manage land, Forest Service, Park Service, BLM, Fish and Wildlife Service, feel very close to the UN bureaucrats, just like the state fish and game and state park and state highway bureaucrats feel very close to the federal bureaucrats. And to be honest with you, they are increasingly more and more like our State Department people in the United States, employees, that feel that they're the only experts that know about what they're dealing with. And really, the people of the United States just aren't smart enough to know all this stuff. So it's really up to them and their colleagues to sort of run these things and take them in the direction they should be taken, whether we're talking about foreign policy. And we see that problem a lot with the State Department. But we have the same problem. We don't see it. We don't talk about it with these conservation agencies and their counterparts of the UN and the state the same way, that they work together and they try to help each other out. It's in the interest of the National Park Service to have the UN highlight the fact that they should expand Okefenokee Park and that they should expand Yellowstone Park and the ecosystem takes in more. We should really think of that as a bigger blah, 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 you know, that's nonsense. Because the more land that goes into the Park Service, the more people they get to hire, the more money they get, the higher their grades are, the bigger their bonuses are, the bigger their retirement is.
Well, my understanding was about 1977, and I'm trying to remember, I think it was during Carter's administration, that they did sign over those parks, and they made them World Heritage Parks.
That's true. They have that dual... the designation, but we're still paying for them. We still put
right.
the people in charge of them, but they are closely managed with the UN, and that stuff is all incrementally increasing over time. It's just not in our best interest. But you see it more and more going on because the politicians know that the guy that's going to pick up his paper tomorrow morning in New York City or down in Miami. His wife will read that in the paper and say, "Oh, isn't that wonderful, Fred? They're going to have a bigger park out there in the Everglades. They're going to have the UN's going to make it a world designated pothole or whatever it is." You know, people like that kind of stuff. But behind it is this increasing authority of the central government of the United States and in the UN over those resources and over what you and I can do and not do in our daily life.
Right, and so when you were getting into the water thing, I thought maybe we could, I mean, didn't you write a little bit on the Law of the Sea Treaty? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah,
That's
a big problem for us right now.
Because, again, that ties in to the UN getting
yep.
control of the water all over the world. Well,
yep.
if the federal government has control of the water in the United States, and we merge with Mexico and Canada to create a North American Union, then the federal government's kind of going to fade into the another entity.
It's oh, yeah. And the court that would enforce the Law of the Sea Treaty invariably is hostile to the United States. Russia signed the Law of the Sea Treaty, but they violated it recently when they went up and planted their flag up under the North Pole, and now are claiming this big slice of land up to the North Pole that, if they are successful, will make them the largest controller of known oil reserves in the world. We're caught in a bind of, you know, when, because this Law of the Sea Treaty thing is floating around out there. I don't know how to put this so I can make it clear here. We want the Law of the Sea Treaty to stop Russia, for instance, from making this claim up to the North Pole like they're doing. But if we do, if we try to do it through the Law of the Sea Treaty that we haven't signed, they aren't going to. The Law of the Sea Court won't help us. They won't help us anyway. And if we were to conduct ourselves as we would have previously, which is to protect our specific interests against Russia doing that, I'm not talking about going to war or anything, but I mean really, really facing up to Russia and facing them down over that. We're kind of caught between two worlds right now. I don't know, and I don't make that any kind of an excuse for the Law of the Sea Treaty, but we need committed, knowledgeable politicians and bureaucrats that represent us, and not the kind of bureaucrats and politicians I've been describing to you, which are simply trying to build the strength of the federal government internally in the United States, kowtowing to the UN and all these international interests because that's what gets them reelected. We need some good politicians, and we don't have them right now.
Well, also with that Law of Sea Treaty, they, from what my understanding is that they would have control of anything that flowed into it. So if you, from my understanding, then it would mean if you had rivers that were polluted, that were going into the sea, they could have control over, you know, what is creating that pollution from the land.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And that would reinforce the Sierra Club or the Wilderness Society or whoever to come in, and the Natural Resources Defense Council, and sue to shut down all of the irrigation along the Front Range, for instance, just as an example, because there's pollution going out of there, and under the Law of the Sea Treaty or under the Law of the UN Treaty that we signed, blah, 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 that's the way that would be used. And the same people would be pushing that pushed the endangered species classification of the jumping mouse.
And I'm not saying that would be necessarily a bad thing, that, you know, I mean, pollution
well,
is pollution.
I'll be honest with you. I think it would be a terribly bad thing. I think that is an internal United States matter, just like it's, you know, China's over there right now making toys for us and all this other stuff and polluting the dickens out of everything. And the world attitude is that they should be exempt from a Kyoto Treaty that supposedly would hobble the United States. I don't think that's right. I think we ought to continue to run our own internal affairs here and not look to, I don't think, international cooperation as a be-all and end-all other than to try to get along with other countries. Okay, I mean, just like I think the states should retain authority and jurisdiction that was given to them under the Constitution, I definitely think the United States ought to preserve all the autonomy from other nations and the UN that we had before they even formed the UN. I think that's, you know, if once you start saying that we can give a little bit of authority to the UN over this, or it'd be good if the UN did that, it's like there's no end to that. You're sliding right on down a slippery slope, and it's going to lead to bad things. Just like once they started taking away federal authority over plants and animals here in the last 25 or 30 years from the state government, there's literally no end to it. They're trying to get invasive species authority. They're trying to pass a Pet Animal Welfare Act right now.
What is that one?
Oh, that's just a Well, they had an Animal Welfare Act now for 34 years or whatever it is now, and that was illegal, frankly. I mean, the federal government was telling medical people and that, how they could use animals and all these.
Oh, okay, all right.
You know, the whatever the Animal Welfare Act, as long as that stood, why not have a pet one now? So they're calling it PAWS, P-A-W-S, and that'll get passed now, because the Democrats, and I'm not being partisan here, I'm just being honest. The Democrats have got a bunch of those kind of laws piled up right now that they've piled up in the House of Representatives and the Senate in the last couple of months in anticipation of the upcoming election. And they're going to be bleeding these proposals to save your pets and to save the whales and to save every other, you know, more wilderness area here and another one over there and to set aside a new refuge over here, all in hopes of getting a lot of favorable publicity and getting sympathetic people to say, well, you know, I really like the way they're doing this and that. So giving away authority to the state, from the state government, giving it to the federal government, they'll go along with all this stuff because they'll get money out of it. And you're going to see another big blurb of expansion of federal authority and power in many of these areas because of this upcoming election.
Okay.
And it's just as plain as the nose on your face. The PAWS thing is an example of a real tearjerker. They'll put some pictures in the paper of a mistreated puppy or something. You know, I mean, look at the emotional outpouring over this football player guy with his dog fighting. I mean, you thought this guy was out there savaging babies or something. And everybody says it's good that he has double jeopardy, or good the state will try him. They don't give him enough time, put him in prison longer over dogs. I mean, that's bad enough. This thing now, this PAWS, will be probably even use that as an example of the kind of thing that the federal government would save us from if they had more authority. So that's the kind of thing that's sitting in Washington right now, looking to increase all of these things we've been talking about.
So ultimately, we're looking at, I mean, you're familiar with, of course, with the wilding of America, and
yep.
And how much land is that ultimately going to encompass?
It'll take as much as it can. That's simple. That's the truth. They don't believe anything anybody else ever tells you. They're going to take as much as they can.
And
just like the National Wildlife Refuges and the parks, and the rest of them will take as much as they can. They're going to how much authority are they going to take over your pets? As much as they can. How much over your livestock and everything? As much as they can. And that's the truth. There is no limit. They're going to take as much as they can for their own benefit and profit and everything else. That's the truth.
And so what do you think, you know, why do you see that they, I mean, my feeling is that if they get that much of this country wilded, then if the country becomes bankrupt, then it puts us in a position to be, hostily taken over, just like a corporation would, for the resources. And then those resources would be done with as a corporation would, which we really don't have much control over corporations. Does that
well? I mean, the people that want to rewild America don't even want to think that far ahead. All they want to think about, literally, is having free roaming buffalo all the way from Texas on up to Montana.
Oh, I'm sure they do, but I'm just wondering if they've, you know, they might need to be looking a little further ahead because.
Well, that's what they make their money off of. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, let's be honest here. How many people look ahead of their own personal interest in anything? It's so rare, particularly anymore,
mm-hmm.
to think beyond what you're going to get for your commodity next year, what the price is, no matter what. I mean, whatever, whether we're talking about doctors, whether we're talking about oil companies, we're talking about people who work for insurance companies, they're all, and there are large numbers of people who are oriented towards the rewilding of America. They meet with and work with the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society and the Humane Society and PETA and the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Wolf Coalition and the Center for Biological Diversity. They're all mixed up together. They all feed off of each other, and they all got their own little part of it that's going to take care of their retirement and get their kids married off and, you know, do all the things that you and I do as we grow older. And the rest of it be damned, you know.
Okay, and then you start looking at places like Anwar or the refuge, wildlife refuge down near us, where they're actually going, you know, your surface in water rights and that sort will probably supersede your land rights, and your resources will, of course, be sellable. So if they're allowing drilling on wildlife refuges, then it kind of shoots all that other wilding in the foot, does it not?
Well, they do what they want to do. The National Audubon Society owns a big refuge down in Louisiana. They've been drilling in for years. And how the federal government ever got so powerful that they can buy a piece of land and then tell the state government that they no longer, the state, it's different than that the federal government bought this land than if Jim Beers bought it. And not only will the federal government not pay them taxes, but they will set any seasons on it or do whatever they want to on it because they're the federal government. When we accepted that, we just encouraged them to say, well, this is a federal, excuse me, this is a federal refuge, and we won't drill on it, or we will drill on it, but that'll be our decision. We'll do what we want. And we won't let you drill off California or drill off Florida because we're the federal government, even though Chavez in Venezuela is using oil against us in the Middle East. People are way overcharging through OPEC for their commodity, and we're sending all this money over there, that some of which is getting the terrorists that are using it back on us. I mean, our federal government is not under our control.
Right, and that's what I'm seeing is that they're actually starting to move a little bit in more into the direction of the UN as being the superseder of
The UN would like to see us not do any more oil drilling.
Okay.
Or natural gas drilling. So that all fits in with national heritage areas and UN areas of importance and, you know, more refuges and more parks to tie up more resources just like they have done up in the North Slope of Alaska. And that further hobbles the United States and makes the United States more amenable to, ultimately, to UN control.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we need bold politicians that work for the interest of the United States alone. They get along with other countries, they do what's best for them and whatever, but we don't sell out the authority that we have over our own nation in order to do any of these other things. And those kind of politicians are pretty darn hard to find. I can count on one hand the ones in Washington, D.C. right now that I think in any way stand in that mold. And a couple of them got whipped very unfairly in the last election because these people poured millions of dollars into their district to get them defeated. Did illegal things to defeat them. The last minute they went around a church parking lots, which is illegal to do, put flyers within a week of the election, put flyers on cars of churchgoers, because churchgoers were known to be heavily Republican, and said that the chairman of the Resources Committee in the House of Representatives, Pombo, that he was supporting gay marriage and supporting abortion, neither of which he did.
That sounds just like the trick they pulled in Texas when Bush got elected.
That could very well be. But that's the kind. They poured millions of dollars into this Pombo's California district, and his big sin was he proposed. Some very mild reforms to the Endangered Species Act. The Defenders of Wildlife and others just poured millions of dollars into his district to defeat him. So, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is or where it's all going, but I'll tell you, I'm very concerned about it. I am very concerned about it.
So what do you think is the most outstanding issue to be paying attention to then at this point in time from your, you know, the background that you have?
I I honestly can't answer that question because it changes from day to day. I mean, they're trying to pass this Pet Animal Welfare Act now. I just got a little publicity note on it. It's full of all this schmaltzy crap about these animals and the pets and how wonderful they are and how, you know, I mean, here we are. We think nothing about abortion clinics going on all over the country, and we're sitting here pining away about puppies. But be that as it may, they use as an example the fact that the Animal Welfare Act has been so successful in protecting animals in the United States. Well, that's nonsense. But anyway, I got a paper right in front of me from last Saturday, big front page article about how the drug makers in the United States are going to ship millions and millions of dollars of what they call clinical testing, which is the use of animals for experiments. They're going to transfer it to India and China. It's a lot cheaper over there, blah, blah, blah. And here we are, losing all of that money for that work here in this country, turning over medical testing to the Chinese that we're all worried about. We don't even want them making our toys for our kids because they're putting lead in the paint, and they're putting date rape drug on little beads or whatever all is going on over there. And we're going to ship this over. And not a word in the articles, not a peep out of the fact that the Animal Welfare Act in the last 30 years has increased the cost of medical use of animals by, you know, 20, 30, 40-fold, and that these very radical veterinarians and university professors, the animal rights people, have taken over these animal use committees and just made it more and more difficult for universities or private labs to do experiments. We've not defended the private laboratories here in the United States very well, and the terrorism and breaking in and destroying records and setting them on fire and letting the animals loose and everything else has just been awful. There's been a tremendous amount of lies and misinformation about testing that the newspapers run routinely about, you know, pictures of rabbits all wired up and all this kind of stuff and lies about it. And they like that because people like to see that and feel sorry about it and everything. So the Animal Welfare Act is really responsible for driving, well, actually it's going to be billions of dollars of testing for all of these different drugs and everything off out of our economy and over to a foreign power that I don't think we ought to be putting that kind of faith in right now, myself, the Chinese in particular. But anyhow, not a word anywhere about this. And based on the fact that the Animal Welfare Act is supposed to have been a success, we're supposed to turn over our pets to them now, too. It's just crazy. I mean, that's just one issue of the kind of things we're talking about that just came up here in the last couple of days. There's the different one. The next day's paper's got this, all this stuff about Saudi Arabia sending all this money over here to these universities to have Islamic study departments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just one thing after another.
So
the upcoming election, this woman, Julie McDonald, that quit as an appointee in the Interior Department over Fish and Wildlife Service and Park Service, was unjustly accused of doing her job, to be honest with you, of trying to make limits on what they were listing as endangered species, lynx and toads and white-tailed prairie dogs, and none of which should have been listed. But the bureaucrats wanted them listed, the lobby groups were talking wanted them listed, so now they're just pillaring her and going to list them anyway. They've gotten her driven out of office and painted her as a bad person when she's just a fine lady. I have a great deal of respect for her. So, I mean, there's so many of these kind of issues. If we can't get good people to come into government jobs and take on these hard jobs because they'll get destroyed like Julie McDonald, if we can't find good politicians to try to reform things or just, by gosh, repeal them like we did prohibition, when you pass a bad law and it doesn't work, you repeal it. You get somebody in there like Pombo that tries to just make a small thing and they pillory him and drive him out of office. I don't know what the answer is going to be.
Well, ultimately, people just have let other people run everything instead of paying attention because to what's going on around them, and it starts down at the local level, and we are being watched, paid attention to by those that are trying to be the change makers, and that is your sustainability and your smart growth and your wilding and all the little things that appear to be being done on the national level is actually coming down to the local level. And if we just start asking questions and looking at it, whether you know you might view one thing or another good or bad, it's just start asking questions, because you'd be amazed at how many of them are able, how much they're able to do just because we're not paying attention.
Yep, that's very true. That's very true. And things like you're trying to do right here, of letting people think about some of these issues, trying to explain them in a way that they can understand them, is the first step. And where it goes from there is up to each one of us to reestablish local control and state authority, and to protect the integrity of the United States government against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
I mean, I understand there's even a global association of mayors. Now, why would there be a global association of mayors? Because, you know, are they representing us globally? Does that mean they're going to be...
Well, I hearken you back to the last election. Okay, last mm-hmm. presidential election. And the arguments about the blue and red states, remember that?
Mm-hmm.
If you look at all those blue areas, they're not really so much states as they were counties around urban areas. We've got a lot of mayors of cities who feel that they don't get enough money to take care of the deteriorating communities under them and the economies under them that are, you know, people don't invest anymore in Cleveland, or they aren't building nice homes in the Bronx or anything. So the mayors feel that they need more money, they need more power. So they look for it anywhere they can get it, and they think the same as a lot of these lobby groups, that they will get assistance from the UN to save the cities and the culture of the cities and blah, 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 and this, that, and the other thing. And they will get it anywhere they can find it. I would mention at this point, did you ever notice how whenever there's big calls for gun control, that the International Chiefs of Police Association always comes out strongly for gun control? And that's because that organization is run mainly by the big city chiefs of police. They give the most money to it, so they get the most say. And the chiefs of police in just about every city are all appointed by the mayor. And the mayors of almost every large city in the United States are anti-gun all the way. They don't want people to have guns. They, you know, they think that if somehow guns went away, they wouldn't have all the crime problems under them they got. But that's not true. But be that as it may, they only appoint chiefs of police that are anti-gun, and will do, if you aren't, they'll fire you. So I mean, they just get rid of you because that's an appointed position. So mayors should not be allowed to join those kind of international groups if they in any way jeopardize the United States sovereignty. And I think we should say that they do. But do you see a governor, or do you see a president, do you see a Speaker of the House or anyone speaking out against that? No.
Because from what I understand, there's an association of governors too, the same way.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they've just changed the name. It's kind of funny the way they change names. They just changed the name in the last year or so of the International Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies to Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies to get around that. There used to be, for years and years in Washington, D.C., the Congress had a big audit arm of auditors called the General Accounting Office, all full of accountants to do audits. They changed the name of, I guess, about 7 or 8 years ago to the General Accountability Office. And now they don't hire auditors anymore. They just hire sociology majors and this and that and the other thing. So they're just sort of a political tool. That's an example of the way the bureaucracy is just crumbling around us, and the kind of lack of leadership that we see from the politicians that we elect.
Well, when you look at the International Building Code, now why would they use the name international unless it really is international? And if, and I'm hearing from those that that there may be something like a GIS system where they will be able to enforce the these international building codes but through satellite. So if that's the case, then wouldn't that also open it up for somebody somewhere else being able to tell tell people in various areas how to meet those codes?
Sure. I'll bet you anything there's probably a UN agreement or convention or something on building codes, because they probably used an example of African office buildings that collapsed or something because of shoddy construction, etc. And that's why they need it. But as soon as they get it signed, then they would turn it on the U.S. to sort of not allow the U.S. to do things that they don't want to do in Europe or in Russia or whatever. They, again, bringing the U.S. more in line with these lesser nations that have far fewer freedoms and liberties in that, and lesser economies because of it, is a big goal of the governments of those countries. And they'll play our mayors and our governors for fools if we let them.
Well, the reason why I was bringing up some of that on, you know, with the UN, because, I mean, if the forests are going to be all under one central, expanding of land, then that would also open it up. Just, it would be a whole lot different than what's happening in Texas, where they're selling off their roadways to a Spanish government. Then it would open us up to the Forest Service selling our forest lands to foreign governments to raise income, would it not?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if they get away with that right now, but they probably could eventually. I just was reading the other day where some American congressman from Tucson, his name is Grivaldas, I think he's an Hispanic guy, just proposed. I think he's on a tax committee or something. But anyway, he proposed a big wilderness declaration for land that would connect a wilderness right on the border with Mexico, a small wilderness. It would connect it all the way up to an interstate so that you can't drive through wilderness, you can't do this, that, and the other thing in the wilderness. I guess only smuggle people into the wilderness to get them up to an interstate. So, there's so many things going on.
Well,
and it's so hard to be conversant in all of them and have an answer for all of them, but they are indeed all related. And if Americans don't consider it important and do something to get control of it, we're in a world of hurt.
Well, if they sit around and listen to, it's gotten to the point where I can't. It's hard for me to even listen to the TV or hear it in the background anymore because of the, it's like looking at the newsstand or at your supermarket where all you're seeing is this gossip stuff. And when you start delving into what is really going on around us, and I mean it's happening daily and weekly, major law changes that are subverting our Constitution and Bill of Rights. And yet at the same time, when you go to the TV, all you'd know is that there was some scandal going on with, somebody that, you don't know, And it's really sad, because if we don't start asking these questions, if we don't start standing up and going to the meetings, and even though they may be as boring as heck, just showing up, asking questions, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? you'd be so much amazed at how much difference that can make, because if they know they're being watched, if you just get with a group of people and say, well, you go to this meeting and you go to that meeting and whatever, and we'll just take turns, at least they'll know they're being paid attention to, because it's when they have secret organizations and they have think that they're not being watched is when a lot of these changes start taking place that affect our lives that we could control.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And it starts with each one of us right where we are locally. But you gotta be bold about it. You gotta bring it up. You gotta talk to your family, your coworkers, and everybody else about it. You gotta get them activated, and they've gotta understand what's going on. Boy,
Well, it's kind of hard when you're told that religion and politics are not something to converse about, and
yep.
That's something we have to change. Politics and religion and whatever affects our lives should be discussed.
That's exactly right.
I mean, expect somebody else who isn't conversing with us? I mean, even those of us that are even active writing our senators and our representatives. I mean, at this point in time, I've found that almost useless, because they're not listening, because they're going where the money is coming from.
That's right. That's exactly right. I've got the same kind of problems here with the politicians in Virginia. Same thing.
But I'll tell you, they start paying attention to you when you start making a difference in your local community, because they still have to come down and appeal to the local communities to get elected.
Well, if enough people will get smart and stand up and not reelect them, that gets their attention. But boy, that's tough to do. Gee, it's tough to do with these federal, as more and more of that power is up there in the federal government, it's getting some control over those federal politicians. It's almost impossible.
And another thing that paying attention to, and again, most of my life I was, trying to make a living and take care of things that had to be taken care of. I didn't have a lot of time for that, but at least at this point in time in my life, I'm starting to realize there's a lot of things going around under our nose that we can make that difference on, just with the Forest Service. And there's a lot of meetings to go to that affect whether they're going to open or close campgrounds, or open or close roads, open
mm-hmm.
or close usage. There's all kinds of things if we start showing up to these things and voicing our opinions.
Yep. Yep. And finding people across the country that have the same problem you do with with road closures or wilderness or whatever, that helps a lot too. The more you can get organized with some people that that are doing the same thing you are.
Yeah, I've run across where they're starting to fee. There's a fee here for this, a fee here for that. And when you start asking questions about the fees, there's three or four different entities charging fees just to go, walk through an area on the river. And one will be, managing the other, but the other one is the one that sets up the fees. And, these sort of things start excluding people.
Yep.
And they all just one thing here and one thing there. Before you know it, I mean, when you have a full family and want to go somewhere and they charge per person just to go through, go to the lake, I mean, you almost have to get an education if you're trying to be a tourist to come into the state, if you're going to various parks and that are run by all these different entities.
Yep, that's exactly right. That's happening all across the country. That's not just out in the West either.
Right, and it's getting to the, and it's not necessarily expensive, and they all, I mean, inexpensive, and they're all raising these fees, and they think they're all justified,
yep.
And they're allowed to keep budgets that are not above board. In other words, they always claim that they're losing money, but they give off to a concessionaire the money making thing that supported the
mm-hmm.
park.
Yep.
So I mean, they're shooting themselves in the foot, or it looks like that. But it's a great thing if you want to keep raising revenue.
Well, none of them that are collecting that revenue want to do the work of running a concession, though. you know, stocking it and putting employees there and taking care of their Social Security and all that stuff. But none of them want to do that. So they try to farm that off and just simply skim fees off the top to for you coming through there.
Yeah, but they don't realize that after a while they're out of a job because the concessionaire is where they really want to put the money, and they're not the everyday running of the park service and that sort of thing is now can be done by fewer and fewer people.
Well, they think they need more and more people, and the politicians give them more and more people every year for environmental education, for invasive species studies, for native ecosystem restoration, all this other stuff they just keep coming up with from the universities that they pay them to justify to begin with. And, I mean, they feel that they're always going to get that.
Oh, really?
And they'll pull that out of your tax money. Congress will give them a bigger appropriation every year.
Well, yeah, but once they're not the popular thing, then they start cutting them down the road. It's kind of like when they keep, you know.
They don't believe they will ever be unpopular. They do not believe that.
But
so whether you're right or wrong, they
mm-hmm.
don't believe it. And the politician thinks he can milk that forever, showing you a picture of puppies and saving cocks and cockfights and saving a wilderness over here and saving a whale over there and all this stuff. They think they can milk that nonsense forever.
Well,
I hope they're wrong, but, you know.
Well, all I hope is, I just, you know, my thing is I just hope people start paying attention to some of these things out there that you know, they appear to be good for you and good for the environment and that sort of thing, but, you know, somebody's out there with an agenda, and it may not be an agenda that's for the best of the people in the country.
Every one of these bad things we're talking about started out being justified as a wonderful good thing that we all agree should, you know, whether it's cleaning up the air or the water or whatever else, it all starts like that, and this is where it leads, and it gets worse and worse.
Well, Jim, I'd like to thank you for coming on the program tonight. And
well, thank you for asking me.
Uh-huh. And I hope maybe that, you know, we at least, you know, got some people thinking about some things anyways.
I hope so, too.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
All right, you have a good day.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
Bye.